An enclave of ethnic Armenians, Azerbaijan muscles in and now has full control of Nagorno-Karabakh. That's led to thousands of Armenians fleeing. Many more will have to decide, should they stay or should they go?
A lot of people are going to be weighing, you know, how bad is it going to be under Azerbaijani rule versus starting over a new life in a new home.
Also today in Washington, a powerful senator is charged with taking bribes in exchange for assistance to Egypt.
The allegations go beyond the simple quid pro quo. It is a suggestion of a kind of broader relationship whereby he was serving Egypt's interests.
I'm Marco Werman, and in Taiwan, creating a distinct culinary tradition, it's about more than just recipes.
Identity plays such a huge, important part in understanding our food culture.
Those stories and a lot more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. A suitcase being wheeled down the street this morning in Nagorno-Karabakh. The video was posted online by an Armenian journalist there. He was among thousands of ethnic Armenians fleeing from Nagorno-Karabakh. It's a primarily Christian enclave in the South Caucasus. The territory is now under the control of Azerbaijan, the predominantly Muslim country that surrounds it on all sides. Journalist Joshua Kuchera has covered the Caucasus region for years and has been watching this story unfold from his home in neighboring Georgia. Joshua, a suitcase on wheels is often the sound of a holiday starting. That is certainly not the case here. Give us a little background on what led up to this apparent mass exodus from Nagorno-Karabakh. How much violence preceded Azerbaijan's takeover last week?
Yeah, so last week, Azerbaijan launched this military assault on Nagorno-Karabakh with the aim of fully regaining control of the territory. You might remember that there was a war between the two sides in the 1990s. That was a very bloody war that ended in an Armenian victory and Armenian forces controlling a large chunk of Azerbaijan, not only Nagorno-Karabakh, which had been populated mostly by ethnic Armenians, but also a large bit of territory surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh. In 2020, there was another war, and this one Azerbaijan won. And in that war, it took back most of the territory that it lost in the 1990s. But some parts of Nagorno-Karabakh remained under Armenian control. And this was the territory where the majority of the ethnic Armenian population, some tens of thousands of people, still was living. Following that 2020 war, the Armenians and Azerbaijanis were in negotiations about the future of this territory. But it seems like last week, the Azerbaijanis lost patience and decided that it was worth it to accelerate the process by taking the territory by force.
Armenians claim the population of Nagorno-Karabakh is about 120,000. Do we know how many of those people are currently leaving?
We don't know. Local authorities in Karabakh say that basically everyone is intending to leave, and it's not surprising given the deep mistrust between these two communities and the fear that Armenians have about what living under Azerbaijani rule would be like. But we'll see. I mean, one political figure, a significant guy, announced today that he's staying. I think a lot of people, you know, don't have any connections in Armenia. Karabakh is their home. A lot of people are going to be weighing, you know, how bad is it going to be for them under Azerbaijani rule versus, you know, starting over a new life in a new home.
So Armenians are largely Christian and Azerbaijan is largely Muslim. Is there a religious dimension to this conflict or is it really driven by something else?
No, there really isn't. And I think that's one of the few things that maybe Armenians and Azerbaijanis will agree with one another on this conflict, that the religion really plays a very small role. And in fact, the cultures really are very similar. You know, a lot of the food is similar. The music is similar. They have, you know, centuries where they live together, really, and the kind of interweavings of the two peoples are really very deep, despite these religious differences.
So if it's not religion, what is the problem?
Well, it's more about nationalism than about religion. Toward the end of the Soviet Union, nationalist movements popped up all across the Soviet Union. And this idea emerged that every territory had to correspond perfectly to the ethnic identity of the people living in it, and coexistence became very difficult. It became a kind of zero-sum notion that made it very difficult for different ethnic groups to be living together anymore, which they had been doing for generations.
Joshua, we're returning to the ethnic Armenians who are leaving Nagorno-Karabakh. How are they leaving the territory? By plane, car, bus, and where are they going to go?
Well, there's no planes. There's a single road connecting Karabakh to Armenia, and that road today was clogged with cars and buses. people leaving to the extent that the local authorities in Karabakh asked people to not leave so quickly, to wait some time so that, you know, there aren't any traffic jams.
I mean, if they go to Armenia, you were talking about this earlier, what kind of life can they expect there?
The Red Cross has set up some kind of processing and aid provision for people crossing the border into Armenia. The Armenian government says it has arranged short-term housing for, you know, anyone who needs it from Karabakh, but that's just a short-term solution in hotels and so on. I think even in the medium term, it's much less clear, and I think a lot is going to depend on perhaps international response and what international aid agencies are able to provide.
And culturally, what connection do these ethnic Armenians have with Mother Armenia?
I mean, I think it depends on the family. Certainly a lot of people in Karabakh have relatives in Armenia that they can perhaps stay with. A lot of people don't. That might make a big difference in terms of who leaves and who doesn't.
Joshua, we see that ethnic displacement has been a recurring chapter in the tension between Armenia and Azerbaijan. How do the events of this past week fit into its history?
Yeah, it's a really awful situation that has been going on. In the Caucasus, wars tend to end with the losing side's population being ethnically cleansed. This is what happened in the 1990s when the Armenians won. 600,000 or more ethnic Azerbaijanis were forced to flee their homes in that territory. You had similar situations here in Georgia when Georgia lost wars in the 1990s and then later in 2008 in South Ossetia with two breakaway territories here. Nearly all of the ethnic Georgians were ethnically cleansed from those territories. Unfortunately, it seems very likely that we're seeing it again now in 2023. Now the ethnic Armenians are being ethnically cleansed from Karabakh. So this is unfortunately part of a pattern in the region.
Reading some reports, I see there are Armenians leaving Nagorno-Karabakh who believe their history in the enclave is over. Like, this is it. This is the last chapter. What does the future of the territory look like? Will Azerbaijan simply incorporate it into their nation, and will its borders disappear now?
I think that the borders are definitely going to disappear. There's not going to be any kind of territorial Armenian unit inside of Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijani government has made that very clear. But what that means for ordinary Armenians living in Karabakh, it's very unclear. The Azerbaijani government promises that people there are going to be treated respectfully and they're going to live with all of the freedoms that normal Azerbaijani citizens have, that every other Azerbaijani citizen has. But for anybody who follows Azerbaijan, you know that that's already not very many freedoms. It's a very repressive government. Secondly, Armenians are a special case, and the hatred between the two sides is really very strong. So it's very difficult to imagine a future for ethnic Armenians living in Azerbaijan freely and happily.
Journalist Joshua Kuchera covers the Caucasus region. He was updating us on the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh as Azerbaijan takes it over and masses of ethnic Armenians flee. Joshua, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
These are 44 boys, 9 to 14, singing in a remote mountain church in northeast Spain. For more than seven centuries, the Escoliana de Montserrat has been singing sacred songs in this abbey run by Benedictine monks. Nothing much has changed over time till now. The school is letting in girls. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Montserrat, Spain.
In Spanish, they call them voces blancas, or white voices, a choir of young boys whose voices haven't yet changed. This is a Sunday Mass in June. No harmonies here in the cavernous basilica, just the high, ethereal echo of sopranos and alto sopranos. The pews are filled with the faithful and tourists who've made the trek from Barcelona, an hour away.
D'història. Se sap que aquí a Montserrat hi havia nois cantant a l'any 1307.
This tradition, says Ephrem de Montaya, dates back to 1307. De Montaya's the headmaster up here, the adjacent boarding school, where the choir boys study and live. The Benedictine Abbey is even older. Since the 11th century, families have been dropping their boys off here. Visits were rare, but the world's changed, and these days parents want more time with their kids, says de Montaya.
Aquí el dubte era de dir, renunciem a la tradició.
For years, the monk sought ways to make that possible, he says, without messing with the choir's strict every weekend schedule. Then, last year, the eureka moment, he recalls. Why not create a parallel choir with boys and girls? It could perform, say, once a month so that the boys in the main choir could have a weekend off. During recess on a recent day, I asked some of the boys what they think about girls singing too.
Muy bueno. Creo que tendrá mucho éxito y...
Very good idea, says 11-year-old soprano Guillem Massabat. I think it will be very successful. We'll be able to rest more and do other things, he says. I can hang out at home or go for walks. The monks held auditions for girls last May. 17-year-old Mireia Espada made the cut.
Vi el mail, ¿no?, que me habían aceptado y me puse a chillar por la casa, en plan llorando, que no me lo creía.
I got the email and just started running around the house screaming, she says. I didn't believe it. I told friends and family right away. During the audition, she says, I knew I had to make this happen, because this has been a dream of mine since I was a little girl.
Vale.
The dream's real now. It's show day, a Monday mass, and Espada is warming the pipes with a little Schubert, then Adele.
There's a fire starring in my heart, reaching my favorite pitch, and it's raining me out of the dark.
Whatever it takes, Espada's nervous. She and the other 27 singers are about to sing in public for the first time. Listening, it's easy to tell the difference between the two choirs. This one's smaller, and members are older, between the ages of 17 and 24. That means the boys, men really, can take on tenor and baritone parts, the young women, the sopranos. For the mixed choir's director, Pau Jorqueras, this new vocal range is the real benefit. He says by breaking with tradition, the monastery has actually made it possible to unlock another tradition that's long been on ice. Jorqueras takes me into Montserrat's Archive of Sacred Music. Inside, rows of shelves are packed with gray folders. In each, sheet music, choral compositions. There are 1,577 different works here, many written by the monastery's own monks over the centuries. Most of them have never been performed, like this one he pulls out from 1810.
No, yo no he abierto nunca todas las carpetas que hay aquí, ¿no? Pero, por ejemplo, esta es una obra de la que solo existe...
I've yet to even look inside all of the folders, says Jorqueras, leafing carefully through the sheet music. I believe this arrangement consists of two choirs plus orchestra, he says. Two choirs of four singers each, in fact, male and female, plus violins, two oboes, trumpets, and cellos.
Claro, esta partitura nadie sabe cómo suena.
No one knows what this arrangement will sound like, Jorquera says excitedly. It'll be so beautiful to have the kids work on it, perform it, and possibly make a recording of it. There's a lifetime of work on these dusty shelves, Jorquera says. And it's today's new voices that will bring this hidden music to life, like Laia Quinquillà, whose pitch-perfect C-sharp is reshaping history. I think this is a step forward, she says, and a great opportunity. It's going to have repercussions for the future. This place has never allowed girls. Even now, she says, I'm still trying to take it in. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Montserrat Abbey, Northeast Spain.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Made in Taiwan is so much more than a stamp on a bicycle or a computer component. There's a new cookbook out that brings Made in Taiwan to the home kitchen. It's called Made in Taiwan, Recipes and Stories from the Island Nation. It's written by Clarissa Wei with Ivy Chen. Clarissa recently spoke with my colleague, Carol Hills.
Now, I want to start by saying kind of the obvious. I mean, the culinary side of Taiwan is really overshadowed by other cuisine from the region, especially China. How distinct is Taiwanese cooking from what we think of as Chinese cooking?
It's completely distinct. And I didn't know this until I embarked on this research process. And I found that Taiwanese food, we have our own condiments, our own flavor profiles, our own ingredients. And by virtue of being an island, we've been a self-ruled democracy for many years. Our cuisine has evolved to be our own. We're not Chinese, and we're not anything other than Taiwanese.
I know you wrote this cookbook in part because China looms so large over Taiwan in the way you're referring. There is this geopolitical aspect to your writing. It's food, stories, and identity, too. I mean, you grew up in California. You now live in Taiwan. Explain how important identity is to Taiwanese food.
It's very important. I think growing up in LA, I sort of conflated Taiwanese food with Chinese food, and that's in part because in the 60s and 80s, when my parents were growing up in Taiwan, Taiwan was under martial law and put under the jurisdiction of an authoritarian government. And people here were told that they were Chinese and were one day going to take back China. This is during the Chinese Civil War. But then Taiwan transitioned into a democracy in the 80s and 90s. And then the sense of Taiwanese identity really became a thing. It became very distinct. And with that came a rise of awareness of what Taiwanese food is. And so identity plays such a huge, important part in understanding our food culture. And having a distinct Taiwanese cuisine, that wasn't a concept 20, 30 years ago, but it very much is the reality here in modern day Taiwan.
I want to get back to the food now. I understand there's a lot of influence from Japan, and this is because of the brutal handover when China turned Taiwan over to Japan in 1895. Tell us briefly about that, but then how it expresses itself in the food.
Yeah, that era was really fascinating and a very transformative era in our culinary scene, because what the Japanese did is they modernized all of our factories and industries. They were the ones who sort of built a train, a railroad track, and connected Taiwan from north to south. But in regards to our food, they sort of monopolized a lot of our key industries. So the way that Taiwanese soy sauce, vinegar, and wine, among other ingredients, are made today are still made with Japanese-era recipes. So our soy sauce is actually more similar to Japanese soy sauce than it is to Chinese soy sauce. Our black vinegar is more similar to Japanese-style Worcester sauce than it is to Chinese black vinegar. And sort of, again, going through these building blocks of our cuisine and finding the similarities with Japanese cuisine was kind of mind-blowing to me. And it kind of explained why in America, when I was trying to make some of these recipes, but using, you know, Chinese ingredients like Shaoxing wine or light and dark soy sauce, why the dish did not taste exactly the same. I mean, it was similar, but there was something off. And it was really, it's really because of the influence of Japan that we have a unique pantry. But most people outside of Taiwan are not aware of that. With the diaspora, like my family, when you move abroad, you're not thinking about what you want from home. You're just trying to make do with what you have and what you can get at your local supermarket.
Clarissa, you're Taiwanese American, born in Los Angeles, grew up in California. What was your own upbringing like when it came to food and cooking?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky I was born in a family of gluttons. My parents brought me to Taiwan every single year during winter break from the age of 2 to 18. And all they did was eat. We're from the south, which is the street food capital of Taiwan. And so my relationship with Taiwanese food formed at a very early age. And some people, some of my friends here in Taiwan are surprised that I know of certain dishes that they even did not know of. And it's just because my parents loved eating street food.
I want to turn to one of your recipes in the book. It's called Quick Seafood Congee. We'll post the recipe at theworld.org. This is a dish your mother makes, and I understand it's a family favorite. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this was a dish that my great-grandmother loved as well. It's really simple. I think most variations of congee, you have to boil rice for a long time, over an hour, and then you add sort of whatever ingredients you want at the very end. But this one is you just take leftover rice, you put it in a broth. It could be a light sodium chicken broth, and then you throw in seafood. Taiwan is an island, so we have an abundance of seafood. So it was kind of, you know, the leftover kitchen sink assortment of the day, and it comes together in 10 minutes. And it's served, you know, at the peripheral of wet markets in the morning, and it's very hearty. You can add celery inside for crunch, and I love it because it's simple and it sort of represents how simple Taiwanese cuisine can be. And I love the seafood aspect because I think a lot of people forget that we are an island and we're surrounded by ocean and have an abundance of seafood available. So it's a family favorite and anyone can make it. You just have to have leftover rice and some seafood in the refrigerator.
You mentioned in the notes in your cookbook that your mom usually keeps the quick seafood congee simmering in a tatung steamer. That's another thing. The dishes and the bowls, they're in the photos in your book. You were really seeking authenticity, weren't you, in terms of what you decided to show?
Yeah, I worked with an all Taiwanese team. My food stylist and photographer, they felt this immense pressure to really represent Taiwan as best as they could in the photography as well. So if, when you flip through the books, every dish, every bowl, every table setting was put there on purpose. And these are bowls and ceramics that would be served in the context of that dish. So, for example, we have an oil rice recipe, and that's usually served when you give birth to a boy and you have a celebration with all of your friends, and it's served in that traditional basin with like red etchings all around. These things are very subtle, and the average American or foreign reader would not be able to pick up on it, but I do have photography notes scattered throughout the books to guide people through this process. And the idea is for these to sort of be Easter eggs. And, you know, it's not just the text that will inform you about the history and the culture of Taiwan, but really the photography as well. We didn't want to just highlight the food. We wanted to highlight the culture and the story and give context for the food in terms of the photography.
Clarissa Wei is co-author of the new cookbook, Made in Taiwan, Recipes and Stories from the Island Nation. Thanks so much, Clarissa.
Thank you so much for having me.
The World's Carol Hills there. We put Clarissa Wei's recipe for quick seafood congee online for you. You can check it out at theworld.org. For immigrants starting a new life in the U.S., a driver's license can make the difference between getting a job and being unemployed. In the state of Maine, new multilingual driver's ed classes are helping to make that happen.
You must know, like left, right, reverse, all those things.
That story and more global news still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Stacks of cash adding up to nearly $500,000, gold bars, and a luxury convertible. Those are some of the items discovered by federal investigators at the home of U.S. Senator Bob Menendez. The New Jersey Democrat is now facing corruption charges. On Friday, he stepped down as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Today, Menendez pushed back against bribery charges, saying that the cash was from his personal savings account and was intended for emergencies. One of the sources of the alleged bribes is Egypt. Michael Wahid Hanna is the U.S. Program Director at the International Crisis Group, and he's written about the U.S.-Egypt relationship. The Fed's charging documents tell quite the story, Michael. Can you break down what they say took place between Egypt and Senator Menendez?
It is quite a story, and it involves significant documentary and forensic evidence that formed the backdrop, really, to allegations of bribery. That Senator Menendez, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, one of the most influential and powerful figures in terms of U.S. foreign policy and national security, was effectively working in the interests of Egypt. You know, this is a fraught relationship, this question of U.S. assistance to Egypt that grew out of the Egypt-Israel peace treaty, but has become a contentious political issue on Capitol Hill in recent years. And there is significant opposition within pockets of Congress and in the Senate to the continuation of the relationship as it existed for decades at this point. And so Senator Menendez fills a very important role in terms of arms sales. He effectively can single-handedly hold up arms sales, as he has done with other partners like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And so Egypt is alleged to have sought his cooperation and assent to allowing U.S. assistance to continue to flow to Egypt.
So a bribe suggests the senator took something in exchange for something else, quid pro quo. So he took stuff, he took these cash and gold bars in exchange for kind of greasing the wheels for more assistance, more military assistance to Egypt?
The allegations go beyond that. They suggest that he provided Egypt with non-public sensitive information, that he effectively prepped some of their officials in terms of what they could expect from questions of from some of his colleagues. So, you know, the allegations go beyond the simple quid pro quo. It is a suggestion of a kind of broader relationship whereby he was serving Egypt's interests.
What could all this mean for the U.S.-Egypt relationship?
This has been a fraught relationship. In the immediate aftermath of the July 2013 coup, the Obama administration...
You're referring to the coup of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi over Mohamed Morsi, the elected
exactly,
president.
Yeah. Exactly. It was then Defense Minister Sisi, who a year later became the president, continues in that capacity to date. It was the beginning of a very rocky period, and the Obama administration eventually suspended U.S. assistance to Egypt. It was eventually, again, reinstated. But the relationship has been marked by dysfunction, suspicion, and even at the beginning of the Biden administration, it was a moment of uncertainty for the bilateral relationship. Then-candidate Biden had had some very harsh words about Egypt, about Egypt's president, and about its record on human rights and democracy. Now, the relationship has a lot of inertia behind it, and we saw that in the early stages of the Biden administration when conflict in Gaza shifted the way in which the Biden administration was approaching relations with Egypt. And that traditional reliance on Egypt for some of these regional roles reemerged, and we saw a softening of the kind of harsh rhetoric that had previously been directed in Egypt's direction.
Now, if we look at Egypt, this is all kind of a head-scratcher because it seems Egypt already has a good case to make for assistance. It's a major regional actor with a serious military involved in lots of security arrangements. Why would they risk anything with this dubious backdoor arrangement with a U.S. senator?
This is an Egyptian military that has become reliant on arms sales and assistance from the United States. And they have been quite keen to maintain, both at a practical and symbolic level, the full amount of the assistance, which traditionally has been $1.3 billion a year. That full amount has come under some stress. There have been efforts and further legislation to make some of that assistance contingent on human rights and democracy conditions. And that has meant that each year now, a portion of the assistance to Egypt becomes an issue of some consideration. And just recently, some portion of that assistance was withheld, millions of dollars. And so Egypt has been very keen to try to lobby people on the Hill to make sure to protect the full amount of that assistance.
Michael, what about this whole scandal interests you the most?
I think that the degree to which Egypt is unwilling to change the way it governs itself. Senators, policymakers have long hoped that this substantial assistance would be leveraged to change Egypt's behavior. There's long been concerns about the human rights record, the authoritarian nature of the current regime, and yet they are nonetheless zealous about preserving this assistance.
Michael Wahid Hanna is U.S. Program Director at Crisis Group. What a wild yarn, Michael. Thank you very much for unspooling it.
Thanks for having me.
Members of the Philippines Coast Guard discovered something strange over the weekend. On patrol in waters about 200 miles west of Manila, they shot video of it for all to see. In this clip posted online, excited Philippine military personnel spot one of their country's islands encircled by a floating barrier. It's a ring of large bobbing white balls linked by cables, preventing any boats from entering. The Philippine government says China installed the barrier. This is just the latest episode in a long-running territorial dispute involving both the Philippines and the United States. The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok is following the story. Patrick, why would China construct this sort of sea barrier that's more than 500 miles from the coast of China?
Well, Beijing says almost the entire sea south of its mainland is Chinese territory. International courts at The Hague have ruled that is not the case, but China's navy has continued occupying little islands, turning some of them into heavily armed military bases and just swarming the entire zone with vessels. This particular island with the barrier around it is just a little nub of land without much on it, but China appeared to be staking its claim and daring the Philippines to react. And when Philippine vessels got close to that barrier, Chinese officers in their own boats nearby got on the radio and said, "You are entering Chinese territory. Turn around."
So what's the reaction been from the Philippine government once they discovered this barrier?
So the Philippines Coast Guard just hours ago launched a, quote, special operation to cut down the barrier by order of the president, Bongbong Marcos. And all weekend, the government has been under heavy pressure to react strongly by an irate public. But they do have to be careful. China has Coast Guard ships all over those waters. And to be clear, a Chinese Coast Guard ship is not some little search and rescue vessel. It's more like a well-armed mini warship, closer to a U.S. Navy destroyer. And Philippine vessels are much older, much weaker, easily bullied. What China has a tougher time bullying is the U.S. Navy. And as of this month, the U.S. is very proactively going out on joint patrols with the Philippine Navy. The barrier may be a reaction to this. And they're cruising through waters that Beijing claims as Chinese waters, even though the U.S. says we're just patrolling with our ally.
Yeah, I mean, it's not hard to see that the situation is potentially volatile. What sort of obligations does the U.S. have if, say, there's a maritime clash of some kind with Philippine military vessels?
The Philippines is a former U.S. colony, and the two countries have a mutual defense treaty. So if either gets attacked, by law, the other has to join in. And in recent years, we have seen Filipino officials trying to get clarity there, asking, would that only cover a major strike against our soil, against our cities? Would the U.S. really jump in if one of our boats got attacked by China? And we now have a pretty solid answer. Vice President Kamala Harris actually went to the Philippines 10 months ago to clear that up.
An armed attack on the Philippines, armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft in the South China Sea would invoke U.S. mutual defense commitments. And that is an unwavering commitment that we have to the Philippines.
Yeah, no equivocation there. Finally, Patrick, what is Beijing saying about all this?
Well, China did not do anything to the Philippine Coast Guard when they destroyed that barrier. Beijing hasn't said anything explicit about this new tactic, walling off islands. But Chinese state media did very recently warn the Philippines, if you keep letting the U.S. use you as a pawn, you might suffer the flames of war. That's a direct quote. So what Beijing really hates are these joint U.S.-Philippines Navy patrols through waters that they call, literally, China's blue soil. And there have been some close calls already, ships barreling at each other, veering off at the last minute. Last year, a Chinese fighter jet coming within 20 feet of a U.S. recon jet. This is as close as the U.S. and Chinese militaries come to real face-to-face confrontations. And for now, China is amping up, not backing down, and the U.S. is matching that energy, recently announcing that there will be even more joint patrols with the Philippines before the end of the year. So it's a dicey situation.
The World's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
An orange-striped parachute unfurled over the Utah desert yesterday, delivering precious NASA cargo safely to Earth.
Touchdown. I repeat, EDO. FRC has touchdown.
NASA's Mission Recovery Operations team there announcing the successful landing of a capsule carrying a sealed container bearing samples taken from an asteroid.
The long journey back 1.2 billion miles from asteroid Bennu back to here with that sample has just come to a dramatic close.
James Traley is a NASA commentator. The asteroid called Bennu, he refers to, is estimated to be 4.5 billion years old, with about one cup of rubble from its surface now in NASA's hands. The mission's lead scientist, Dante Loretta, will be chaperoning that sealed canister today when it's transferred from Utah to NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. A specially designed lab is ready and waiting. NASA scientists say the asteroid samples are building blocks from the dawn of our solar system, and they will help scientists better understand how Earth, and maybe life on Earth, first formed. Cars, those symbols of independence, where in a fantasy world you can just drive off and have a big adventure. Bottom line, for many people, you need a car to get to work, a simple fact of life where mass transit is lacking. For many immigrants in the U.S., even people who have driven for years in their home countries, language barriers can complicate getting a license. Now, a small but growing number of multilingual driver's ed schools are helping English language learners get up to speed. Ari Snyder with Maine Public Radio reports from Lewiston, Maine.
Tout est temps qu'on avance légèrement et on regarde les deux côtés, c'est clair, on part.
Ghislaine Lumbu, a recently arrived immigrant from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is behind the wheel of a white Toyota Camry. He's headed down a residential street in Lewiston as an instructor with Bourges Driving School gives directions in French.
On arrive au île, on tourne à droite, devant, là-bas, on avance.
Lumbu grips the wheel at 10 and 2, dutifully scans his mirrors, and keeps a consistent speed just below the posted limit. But Lumbu is no stranger to the driver's seat. He says he worked at a gas company for 13 years, driving tanker trucks through what he described as the crowded, often chaotic streets of Kinshasa, the Congolese capital city of 17 million people. Speaking in French, he says driving in Maine is really different.
C'est vraiment plus sécurisant la route et il y a beaucoup de règlements qu'il faut à tout prix respecter.
The road is a lot safer, he says. There are a lot of rules that you must respect at all cost. A course at Bourges Driving School runs $550, and students without work authorization often get financial support from a handful of local nonprofits. That includes Lumbu, who says he wants to get his driver's license to make the job search easier once his work permit arrives. He chose this school so he could learn in French. St. Clair Biro is the school's owner. He says it's not uncommon to be juggling a mix of languages in the classroom. He has students who speak French, Portuguese, and Lingala, and course material is largely written in English.
It's kind of hard, but I have to make sure the information go out with everybody.
Biro, originally from the Central African Republic, says he opened the school a few years ago, specifically to meet the needs of multilingual students. He says teaching certain English words is part of the curriculum.
You must know, like left, right, reverse, all those things. I prepared them on that.
Beth Stickney, an immigration law and policy consultant, says getting a driver's license is an important step for new arrivals looking to build a life in Maine.
Just as it is for any Mainer. I mean, that is just hugely important for work and family mobility.
Still, she says, there are pitfalls beyond language barriers for immigrant student drivers. For instance, understanding that after getting a learner's permit, they still need another licensed driver in the car.
Because they're like, I've been driving for decades. Why do I need my teenager who just learned how to, or my 21-year-old who learned how to drive only 2 years ago in the front seat with me?
And Stickney says the consequences of an infraction can be more severe for certain immigrant learners, because even civil violations could count against them in immigration proceedings. Multilingual driver education programs are not the only option for English language learners. The Maine Bureau of Motor Vehicles says it provides interpreters free of charge to students enrolled at approved driver education programs in the state. But Rilwan Osman, who runs SNA Driving School in Lewiston, says he sees steady demand for direct instruction in Somali.
The older generations, Somali, and there are a lot of new people coming into to the city, and a lot of them don't speak English.
But he says language barriers remain an issue outside the classroom. The BMV doesn't allow interpreters to ride along during the road test. It says the lag time in communication could present a safety hazard, and that since a driver's license allows someone to take the wheel independently, the road test should also be taken without assistance. Osman says he encourages his students to call him the day of their driving test to review key vocabulary such as e-brake and high beams. His hope is to keep his students from failing based on a language mix-up alone.
I will give you 1 hour to kind of go through the things that they might ask you when you go for your test, so that at least you have an idea of those basic things.
Meanwhile, Ghislaine Lumbu, the truck driver from Kinshasa, is finishing up his practice session. Instructor St. Clair Biro asks how he's feeling.
Comment tu te sens?
Ça va?
Good, Lumbu responds.
Plein de confiance.
Full of confidence. For The World, I'm Ari Snyder in Lewiston, Maine.
Imagine a school with no exams and no grades, where students sing together and every morning they discuss global affairs. That's exactly what happens at a folk high school in Elsinore, Denmark. The World's Amanda Lichtenstein went there to talk with students about their experiences.
At the International People's College, or the IPC, over 100 students from around the world wake up every morning and sing together. The tree-studded residential school on the outskirts of Elsinore is just an hour by train from Copenhagen. On a drizzly, overcast day, I meet Marta Kostev, a 23-year-old student from Lviv who won a scholarship to study here. She says she read about the opportunity in a group chat.
So I applied for it, and I'm really glad that I joined this, because I always supported the idea of lifelong learning. And I think that it's nice to experience living in a new country.
Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, 27 Ukrainian students have been accepted to study at Danish folk high schools to learn about democratic change and civil society building, which is what the folk high school system is all about. Sarah Mortensen oversees international partnerships at the Association of Folk High Schools in Denmark. She says before the war, she was already in touch with Ukrainian educators.
A very clear message from them was, please open your schools for our youth. Yeah. Because they need something meaningful to do while the country's in state of war. And we need to prepare and build strong individuals for a time after the war.
Students here do everything together. Eat, sleep, study, dance, debate, make art, and talk a lot about peace.
So the everyday life, it depends on what you make it.
That's 22-year-old Kirill Karuna from Kyiv.
So you can either be in your room for the whole day, or you can get out of your comfort zone and talk to people and just see where it takes you.
Denmark's 70 unique folk high schools all embrace the spirit of Bildung. That's a German word to describe learning that blends personal, moral, and civic education through shared values like cooperation and dialogue. NFS Grundtvig is the creative genius behind Danish folk high schools, says Soren Lonberg, the school's principal.
He was a priest, he was a poet, he was a politician, he was a pedagogical thinker, and he was a philosopher. And basically, Grundtvig's thought was that, you know, we need to educate the Danish population. Sons of farmers who only had very little education at that time.
In 1849, Denmark made a major leap from an absolute monarchy to democracy. Lonberg says Grundtvig wanted to turn these schools of the dead into schools for the living, which includes lots of singing together. But it's not folk songs that brought Pakistani student Nadeem Abbas to the IPC. After a decade working in human rights in Islamabad, 41-year-old Abbas says he was searching for a stress-free environment with no assignments or exams where he could reflect. And Abbas says that while it's not quite a utopia here, he has learned a lot about himself by observing other cultures.
Here I have learned that I should trust other people, and it is not a bad thing to trust blindly. It should be followed just like a faith.
Kirill Karuna says,
I can relate to blindly trusting people because I think this is 6 months. It feels like a simulation of life where you can be whatever you want. You cannot help but fall in love with this whole concept.
But Kostev says it's been hard to be so far away during the war.
For me, things I learned about myself is that even if you move abroad, you can't get rid of your problems. So they are still moving with you whenever you are.
Still, this kind of learning has become a blueprint for nation building, drawing the attention of American civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. and Miles Horton, who studied here in the 1930s and later founded the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee. Today, a small group of Ukrainian visionaries see folk high schools as a key to post-war possibilities. Ukrainian educator Elena Tochilina is currently in residence at the IPC. She's a co-founder of Bildung in Ukraine, a group that wants to create the country's first ever folk high school. She says the need for change in Ukraine started back in 2013, just before Russia first invaded and annexed Crimea.
We were very clear that revolutions sometimes are needed, but it's better to evolve through self-development, through education.
And she hopes Ukrainian students like Kostev and Karuna will bring back the spirit of Bildung to Ukraine. But for now, there's more singing. For The World, I'm Amanda Lichtenstein, Elsinore, Denmark.
The Berlin Marathon is known to be fast. The course is flat with only a few sharp turns, and the late September date usually means ideal temperatures. So generally, elite runners show up and are predicted to run well. Even so, the final times from yesterday's Berlin Marathon blew expectations out of the water.
The Brandenburg Gate then beckons for Tigist Assefa.
Ethiopia's Tigist Assefa was under world record pace for most of the race, but it was in the home stretch that it all became real.
Look at the 2:11 on the clock. She's got 300 meters to go. Can she get up to 2:12? I think she can.
And she did. Assefa crossed the finish line in 2 hours, 11 minutes, and 53 seconds, smashing the previous world record by more than 2 minutes, a massive improvement rarely seen in marathoning. Her average pace was just over 5 minutes per mile, which surprised even her. Assefa said she never expected to break the world record by such a wide margin. She'll now be a major contender to watch for at the Summer Olympics in Paris next year. She wasn't the only woman to set a world record yesterday. Switzerland's Katharine de Brunner won the women's wheelchair race. Her time was 1 hour, 34 minutes, and 16 seconds, taking nearly 90 seconds off the previous best time. It's only the beginning of marathon season, so let's see if the shiny new records hold up through the fall. And that's going to do it for us today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. Hope to see you back here tomorrow.